meeting was delayed. And he came back and he said, the generals decided to have this meeting. And so Admiral Zumwalt was sitting around like the board table, if you will. I was sitting up against the wall with the aides. And one thing you had to remember is that the Army was so big in Vietnam and the Navy was so small that your counterpart was generally a full colonel and you were a lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
That type of thing went on all the time. It seemed like everybody at MACV headquarters was either a general or a full colonel. So I was constantly interfacing with full colonels, and I was a lieutenant in the Navy, which was, you know, made it cumbersome and difficult. But anyway, we're sitting there. I was the junior person in the room, and General Abrams came in, and I had never seen him except that day that we'd gone over with Beth. And he looked like a general supposed to look, you know, a wartime general. He had that build, he had that physical appearance. He had this big cigar he always carried around. It was sort of a signature with him, you know, this cigar. And he sat down and hardly said anything. He said, let's get going. Well, the first service that was to give its presentation was the Air Force. And the senior Air Force commander was General Brown, who became chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was then a lieutenant general. I think he was the first Air Force chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in history. I forget his first name. His last name was Brown.
Brown.
He was then the commander of the 7th Air Force. And he was sitting there. And these two good-looking Clark Kent-type colonels got up to give the presentation. I mean, they were right out of Hollywood casting. You know, the uniforms were perfect, you know, tailored. I mean, it was really... And the first slide went up. You got to keep in mind that Admiral Zumwalt and I did this with a magic marker and flip paper flip charts. Now here was the Air Force. The first slide comes on and it's got thunderbolts on the, you know, the Air Force crest, and thunderbolts, and it's red, white, and blue. And I'm sitting there saying, oh shit, wait till he sees our, you know, our, we got, I didn't even know if I had the spelling right, you know. And we hadn't had time to check because we worked on it until late at night. And so all I remember is I'm terribly impressed with the Air Force. Of course, I'm not paying any attention to what they're saying. I'm looking at the way they're saying it because I knew I was going to have to get up, and I was comparing myself with them. And I knew there was no way I was going to compare to these good-looking colonels and these slides. And so I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, Abrams hits the desk, the table, the board table with his fist. And this big brown ashtray, it's a standard government-issued ashtray, went up in the air, turned over, and came crashing down on the table. And everybody just stuck. And I was mesmerized, you know. And I still remember Abrams said, bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. That's all I ever get out of the fucking Air Force is bullshit. That was exactly what he said. I still remember it. And then he proceeded to say, by the way, their slides showed that they would, it was going to take another 3 years to do, you know, whatever they were going to do. And Abrams said, this is 1968. Abrams said, Do you think you're going to be here till 1971? Is that your plans, General? He's talking to General Brown now. He said, that's what you're telling me? He said, you people have any idea what's going on in the United States? He said, do you have any idea the pressure cooker environment the president is in? He said, there's an election going on. He said, I have just returned from a private meeting with the President of the United States. He said, I had right here, and he patted his, from my pocket, orders from the President. And those orders are to get this war over and to get the hell out of Vietnam. I said, I'm going to give everybody an opportunity to get behind this. He said, I'm going to have the command structures of our forces. But he said, if I've got to bypass them, he said, I've got direct orders. You know, words, you know, what he was basically saying was that, you know, the whole Pentagon, the whole chain of command and the armed forces better understand what my orders are, because he said, I'm going to execute them whether they go along with it or not. In effect, that's what he said. Got up and he walked out of the room. And nobody wondered, we didn't know whether the meeting was over or what. And his chief of staff, General Goodpaster, came back in. And he said, Abe is taking a little break. He said, he's very tired. And he said, he'll be back. And he said, we will complete this meeting. And then walked up to Admiral Zumwalt. He says, buddy, he said, I know you're brand new in here. He said, you haven't had an opportunity to really get your arms around this thing. He said, would you like to brief General some other time? Well, Zumwalt was sitting there like the guy that had just drawn to the inside straight. Because this whole presentation, he was worried that it was too aggressive. Mm-hmm. Well, Abrams had just said, he wanted it to be even more aggressive. And Zumwalt looked at him and he said, no, he said, Andy, he said, I think I'd like to go ahead and do this today. Well, that's when he got me. And we went into a room and we went through these flip charts. And all the maybes became wills. we might do this became we will do this. This could be difficult, this won't be difficult. You know, I mean, we changed the emphasis of this presentation altogether. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have, so we were basically crossing out words and writing new ones. I mean, bear in mind the Air Force had just put this beautiful slide up, mm-hmm. and all we had was these flip charts. So we got back, General Abrams came back in, and the Admiral said, Howard, he said, I'm going to give this presentation. He said, you just flip the charts. And I said, that's fine with me. don't worry about that at all. And it was pretty aggressive. He got about halfway through it. And the Army senior advisor, so Major General, I forget what his name was, said, this is a bunch of bullshit. He said, there is no way that you can accomplish this. He said, you don't have the resources to do this. And Abrams looked at him and he said, shut up. He said, I want to hear him out. He said, he may be digging himself a big hole, but he said, you're already sitting over there in a cesspool. So anyway, Zumwalt proceeded to continue to, and by the way, he didn't have the resources. He, you know, this was just conceptual at this point. Mm-hmm. Abrams said, listen to him, very politely, he finished. And he said, Admiral, he said, I want to know the following. He said, I want to know what part of this plan you can implement at your level with the resources you currently have. I want to know what portion of this plan requires resources from what part of the Navy that you currently don't have, you know, you don't have. I want to know what other part of this plan requires the support of the Vietnamese that you currently don't have. In other words, I like your plan. I think it's unrealistic at this point because you don't have the resources, you don't have everybody behind you. He said, this was a Friday, and he said, when can you have this to me? So I said, Monday. He said, Monday.
So your weekend was cut out for you then.
Abrams said, how are you going to get, he said, Admiral said, generally said, I may not have all the approval on this up and down the chain of command, but he said, I'll have this thing flushed out, I'll have this detailed for you, and he said, I'll list to you who we need to get authority from, when I think I can have that authority, and Abrams said, he turned to the Army guy and he says, I'm not going to hear any more today, and he got up and he started to walk away, and he turned around and he said, Admiral, he said, come with me. Zumwalt walked over and Abrams put his arm around him and they walked down to his office, and that was the beginning of a tremendous relationship. And then we went back to the headquarters and I got the people together and Zumwalt told them what we'd done and they all shook their heads. But on Monday, I remember I worked all weekend, everybody worked all weekend. Christ, we were up till 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, but we had a document that we had in the hands of MACV by 4 o'clock on Monday afternoon that answered the mail that, that Abrams had asked for. And it was the beginning of what became ACTOV, to turn everything over to the Vietnamese.
Had that name been attached yet?
No, that acronym had not been flushed out yet. And I don't think it was on that document. So that's the story that he was referring to.
What was your sense after this had happened, looking around that room, when all of a sudden everybody realizes that the Admiral Zumwalt was way ahead of the curve here, and they sort of...
Well, he was ahead of the curve intellectually and conceptually, but they were very reluctant to believe that. They all thought he was going to fall flat on his face because he didn't have the resources, and they didn't think that he had the ability to get this thing done. You know, they didn't have any respect for the Navy. Much of it, they didn't even know anything about the Navy. You know, and Zumwalt at that point, I don't know that he knew that. You know. Who the hell was going to do all this? But it was consistent with what he had told me when we landed. See, that's why I tie this together. I think he had made up his mind either during the briefings coming over or before he'd even left his last job that one of the primary missions he had was to get this thing turned over, and he had given himself an 18-month time frame to do it. As I told you, Humphrey got elected at 5-6, and Nixon got elected when he was 18. And the election was only then about a week away. Because Johnson called a bombing halt as a result of this meeting with Abrams in an effort to help Humphrey in the election. It wasn't enough.
Right.
But that was the purpose of it. He wanted, before Johnson was going to call this bombing halt, he wanted to make sure that the commander in Vietnam would support it. Mm-hmm.
So after the admiral set up this scheme that became ACTOV, he then had to turn around and go up the chain of command and say, this is what I've done, you're going to back me up on it.
Yeah, but what began to happen was the chain of command. Zumwalt would go up the chain of command and they would stall or say no. And then Abrams would send it up to his chain of command, and then it would come down on top of the guys in the Navy.
Right. His was more direct.
His was more direct.
He went directly to the Joint Chiefs, right?
That's right. And if so Zumwalt wasn't getting the support he needed up the chain. and this, the reason I know this was happening was that the first month or so we were in country, senior people in the Navy who would visit Saigon sometimes wouldn't even come over to the headquarters. They'd stay, stay someplace.
The Big Mac V compound.
Big Mac V compound, separate. Seventh Fleet. There was this constant parade of people coming to Vietnam. And after that meeting, after Zumwalt's reputation began to emerge in Vietnam, all of a sudden we had Sink Pack Admiral McCain staying with us. We had Admiral Hyland's Sink Pack fleet staying with us. We had 7th Fleet staying with us. I mean, they all began to court Zumwalt. Because word was coming down from the Joint Chiefs. This combination of Sea Lords and this ACTOF. Simultaneously, here's a guy that was going to shake things, was shaking things up in Vietnam. But he wasn't just doing it in the Navy. He was making a contribution to Abrams. We used to do a lot of Abrams used Zumwalt as a sounding. He began to bring Zumwalt into his decision-making group. See, and then they had these Saturday morning intelligence, and then we began to get involved in that, and we started making these presentations on Saturday morning, which the Navy had never done. The Navy had never even been invited to do it.
And this is because of Admiral Beth.
Because of Admiral Beth. And the Navy was sort of static, This friend of mine in the PBR said, the only thing I've done for 6 months is to rush pregnant Vietnamese women to a hospital. My boat. So, in other words, they weren't. Here the Army were taking tremendous casualties. The statistics. It's sort of a morbid way to measure involvement. But the Navy wasn't taking any casualties. The boats were. And when Zumwalt got there, that was one of the side effects of Zumwalt's involvement. Was we started taking a lot more casualties.
But oddly enough, morale went up too, right?
Oh, morale shot up tremendously. So, we'd get up in the morning, and the first thing Zumwalt would do would be to go over the messages the night before, and wherever the firefights were, that's where he and I would be in the helicopter right away, and we'd be right out there.
Mm-hmm. What was your role on these trips?
I was like an official recorder. When we get back, I'd do memorandums of follow-up. If Zumwalt said he was going to, he'd ask these guys, what do they need? My job was to make sure that that was all recorded so when we got back, and then to get to the action officers in Saigon and make sure they understood and got it done, and then to follow up to make sure they did it. That was sort of the role that I played. And Zumwalt got authority to give medals. I used to carry medals in my briefcase. While Zumwalt was talking to people, I'd be finding out who were the guys that had taken the biggest hits that night and had done something significant, and I'd line them up and I'd tell Zumwalt, I got 3 guys out here for 2 Navy Commendation Medals, this, and then he'd pin those things on them right like, the impact was phenomenal. The impact was phenomenal.
He mentioned to me that you would also carry beer out in this helicopter, and they'd all gather around and have a beer together.
Uh-huh.
And so this is interesting in that these men, most of them, like you said, very young, have never ever gotten this kind of attention from that high up the chain before.
They never saw anybody. Nobody.
So from your point of view, obviously the attention of these men is focused on, here's the Admiral, he's come to see us. And since you're sort of back behind, observing, taking notes, what sort of things do you see when this happens, on these trips, when the Admiral takes these steps?
Well, what I see is, first of all, people that are the response that any people in an organization have when a, you know, when the leader shows up, demonstrates an interest in what they're doing, seeks their advice, or talks to them. He serves as an inspiration to them. He relates to them. They know that that somebody up there really cares and is interested, and that there's some purpose to what they're doing. All those things tend to flow from a, plus, he's sort of an inspiration. There's somebody that knows right away what happened to them last night, was right on the scene in the morning. That has a tremendous impact. He became like a Vince Lombardi to these guys, some great leader all of a sudden. That may not be the right person to, but I mean, they had such respect and admiration. Every organization wants to look to its leader for guidance and inspiration and involvement, and he gave them all that. Plus, when he came back to the staff, he had firsthand information. Mm-hmm. He wasn't waiting for the staff to brief him based on what they had read in some message. He'd already been out there. Some staff guy would stand up and say something, some would say, wait a minute, goddammit, I was just out there an hour ago. If you want to know what's going on, get your ass out,
Get out from behind the desk.
Get out from behind the desk and get out there and find out what the hell's going on.
How long did it take? The Admiral would go out and he would see these things. You would record what the Admiral wanted done. Mm-hmm. How long would it then take for these perceptions that you got out in the field to be turned around and actually become guidance or orders?
Well, some things happened right away, depending on what it was. Other things that took time to make it happen. And some things, they never happened at all. So you can't really, you have to take it almost on a case-by-case case basis. But I'll say this, that staff people began to head out into the field because they knew that they didn't want to stand in front of the Admiral and start talking about something, and the Admiral would talk to the people out in the field about it.
Plus, if the Admiral sets that kind of example of, I'm out in the field, why aren't you? Then there's almost a feeling that it's obligatory to do it as well.
Well, let me tell you that Zumwalt was fearless in that regard. There were a lot of helicopter crashes in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. A lot of helicopters shot at in Vietnam. We were shot at. I remember we went to a firefight, to a base where there was a firefight up on the Cambodian border. I mean, we were stepping over the dead VC. I mean, they were still on the ground when we got there. Zumwalt's impact cannot be exaggerated. The contrast between him and death, the way he energized that command structure, the sense of direction and purpose that he gave to naval forces in Vietnam, was remarkable. Knowing all along that his primary responsibility was to disengage. So you see, you have this, on the surface, this conflict. He's engaging our forces, while at the same time trying to disengage them.
Going out with a bang.
Pardon?
Going out with a bang.
And Abrams saw this and admired this and saw the Navy making a contribution. It took a while for this to sink in Washington. They were geared to the carriers and supporting the carriers. you know, all the top flyers were in Vietnam. But that wasn't true with the people in country, as I've said to you. And pretty soon word got out that, you know, we had the best young people, but the careerists, you know, they were not, they were the ones that didn't.
Right, because they had the perception that, you know, Vietnam is not career enhancing for,
right,
for naval line officers. And
that's right. Whatever you did over there for that year, you're going to have to make up because you didn't do it. In other words, you could have been aboard a destroyer as a department head. Now you're going to be behind your year group because you spent a year in Vietnam, and you have to make that up.
Right.
And it was troubling to these people who were there. They had been told, go to Vietnam, we'll give you a good tour when you leave there, and they weren't getting it. So Zumwalt really began to fight the institution over this issue. My own feeling was, is that, as I told you, that they did not... they did not support the war in Vietnam. In fact, there were career officers who fought going to Vietnam, didn't want to be a part of it. And I remember one time I said, you know, what's the difference between some kid burning his draft card and going off to Sweden or Canada and some naval officer who decides that he doesn't want to go to Vietnam, but he legitimately finds a way to avoid it? Mm-hmm. This is some of the things that happened in this war.
Mm-hmm. I guess the Admiral fought the system in both ways. He not only fought to get good assignments for the men after they were done, but he also had to go to the top to get good people sent in to start with, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I used to listen into the phone calls. So he would call from Saigon. He'd call the chief of naval personnel, a fellow named McDuncan, and he was constantly after. After better people to come out there.
What was your sense of how Duncan or the system responded to that?
Bureaucratically.
But as, you know, we know that since this is a war, this is the priority, we're going to do our best. And
yeah, but the Navy, once again, this was a sideshow. Not going to let anything happen to the readiness of our 7th Fleet, the readiness of our 6th Fleet. We have commitments around the world. And every now and then a token person would arrive, and that was this, you know, sign that, you know, we are supporting you, Admiral. We're sending the best people over there. It just wasn't the case.
Well, given that the Navy was obligated to maintain this traditional mission of sea control or the forward fleets or whatever, was it maybe not an incorrect view on their part to say, well, I mean, we understand there's a war on here, but we've also, I mean, how do you think that...
Well, my position on that was that the men were dying. Mm. This country was committed to war. We were supposedly the warriors of the country. By God, this is the number one priority.
Right, and so...
So if there was somebody that, you know, that maybe wasn't as... If you had to choose between the number one guy and the number two guy, put the number two guy on the ship in the 6th Fleet and send the number one guy over to Vietnam. The Admiral constantly made the point that better leadership, better people will save lives. Better leadership, better people will get us out of Vietnam sooner.
And he had to fight that all the time.
He had to fight that all the time. And they just didn't. They didn't get it, or they didn't respond.
And this contact with Washington was more or less constant then.
Oh, yeah.
Trying
call,
to...
all the time. Messages, calling. They'd send people out to try to say, well, we're sending you the best people. They'd send peacemakers out from Washington.
And of course, that was, I guess, an attempt to keep the admiral at arm's length, and it didn't work very well.
But it didn't stop him. I mean, nothing he worked at, but, you know, the admiral never said, well, just because I don't have the good people, I can't use that as an excuse. You know, I'm going to get by with what I got. I'm going to do the job with what I have. I prefer better people. I don't mean to suggest that everybody was out there, wasn't I? I mean, hell, I was there. But bear in mind that the people we're talking about are not the lieutenants and below. It's, you don't make the distinction between, whether you're at the JG level or the lieutenant level. We're talking about up at the senior level. He called three commanders in from the three task groups. 115, 116, whatever it is. I was sitting there. Five of us in the room. Now, all three of these were captains. Not one of them would ever have been a flag officer. Schalzer was 117. River. Support forces for the 9th Army. I forget the guy that was 116. He was an aviator. Hadn't flown for years, but he had wings on. And there was a fellow that was market time, the 115 guy. He was kind of an outspoken surface guy. Some older called him into town to brief them on his concept for Sea Wars. He told them that he was going to make sure that every single one of them was a flying officer. And he did. They all made flag.
Was Art Price one of those?
Art Price was 116. He never made flag. Bob Salzer, 117. He was a Yale graduate. Bob was. He told me that night, you know, that this was his last tour in the Navy and he was getting out, you know. He said, there's no way that this guy can get me, you know, promoted to fly. Bob Hoffman was the 115. You know, there's no way he was going to be a flag officer. So, he lived up to his commitment when he became CNO. Every one of these guys was a flag officer. But he had encouraged the flag boards right away to select these guys. He said, look, I have got to have somebody selected out of this command. I've got to demonstrate to people in the Navy that this is not a wasteland, that you come over here and you've got an opportunity to be a flag officer. So he was trying to battle this perception. And of course, you know, half the flag officers in the surface Navy have been commanders of cruisers. Everybody wants to be the commander of a cruiser. So that's what... So his rationale for wanting this was not for them personally. He wanted it for the effort. He wanted it for recognition for the in-country effort that the Navy was doing, to give status to it, you know. All the carrier flag officers had commanded carriers in the Gulf of Tonkin. They had flown off the carriers. They had bombed North Vietnam. But we hadn't had anybody that had been to Vietnam who was a surface officer who had been selected for flag. Mm-hmm. He saw that as a real priority. And that's why people said, why should I go over to Vietnam? I'm not going to.
Dead end.
It's a dead end. So he promised them that night he'd make a flag officer. I don't think they believed that he could deliver on that. Nobody thought he was going to be CNO. Nobody thought, you know, this was early on in the, this is, you know, granted he had a good reputation. He was a young officer. the youngest three-star in history and all that, but that's a far cry from, nobody would have said, well, this is 1968, in 2 years he'll be the chief of naval operations. They would have committed you to a hospital
But if they had known that, they would have treated him a lot differently.
Oh, of course, but see, there were people that told me that, people were happy when Zumwalt got out of the Pentagon. They thought he was going to Vietnam, so his career was over.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the impression that Zumwalt himself had, right? That, you know, Tom Moore's sending me over here basically to get rid of me.
Yeah.
Right, so kind of bury me in Vietnam.
Yeah, they'll give me my third star and bury me over in Vietnam. So you see, that was the attitude of the whole institution of the Navy about Vietnam. Isn't that incredible? Here we are fighting this war. We're fighting this war. We're committed to it. Congress is passing the authorizations and appropriations every year. And one of the institutions that is charged constitutionally to fight our wars is basically not supporting it. I've always found that to be an incredible indictment of the Navy and Vietnam.
Maybe that's, you think that's an attitude that, existed from the top simply because the Johnson administration is trying to fight this war on the cheap. They're trying to do it without making too many waves.
The Navy did not want to be in country. There was no question about the support of the 7th Fleet.
Just the
this in-country thing was just a drag. It was a financial drag. We had 40,000 sailors in there. We had all these kind of boats. It was just a huge drag.
Did the very youngest sailors and officers, the men out on the river, did the commanders of the PBRs, the sailors on the PBRs, did they have this impression that we're somehow a red-headed stepchild to the rest of the Navy?
No, they didn't have a sense.
This was only higher up.
I think they had the sense in Vietnam that somehow we weren't equal to the Army and to the effort that was being made. As I said, that's when Zumwalt began. His stature grew in Vietnam. The stature of everybody grew in Vietnam.
Right. How much of a role did you have in terms of the staff when it's time to sit down and develop a concept like Sea Lords or ACTOF? Or is your role more in terms of being the Admiral's aide and sort of keeping track of all of this?
No, I don't want to exaggerate my role. I was there to keep track of it, but also I was, as people used to say, I'd become his alter ego, but I was very much involved with it. You know, a lot of I don't think I ever conceived of any one thing all on my own. But I remember one day I don't know if you've ever heard the term slingshot.
Mm-hmm. Jet slingshot.
He called me in one day and he said, read that on the board and then let you and I talk about it. And he had outlined the slingshot. So in that sense, I used to write a lot of he would want to give his advice to Abrams, and there was a political dimension to it, or something that he wanted to discuss from a historical perspective. I used to write a lot of that. Or if he had written it, he'd give it to me to, to comment on, to improve on, or whatever. Plus, as things developed out in the field, I used to go out in the field a lot and spend 2 or 3 days here
without the
Admiral, talking to people, finding out what was going on, and then coming back and saying, look, here's what I discovered.
This is sort of a troubleshooting.
I went down with the SEALs and went on a mission one night with them. I'd do things like that for him. And I worked I'd say majority of my job was really working with other staff people, helping them respond to him. Mm-hmm. People didn't know how to respond to him.
So you were almost kind of the go-between.
I was the go-between. Very much so. As I said, I was with him practically every morning out in the field. Mm-hmm.
And then, in addition to that, you were on the field on your own.
On my own.
Gathering information.
Yeah, I'd sometimes go out for 2 or 3 days at a time and visit a base and stay there. And I talked to people. I'd come back and I'd say, these young guys are, they need this, they're not getting that. And we started a program of debriefing people when they left country. Not, generally, if he was a squadron commander, the PBR squadron, sometimes a young lieutenant, or somebody I had met out and was impressed with. And as they came through Tonsonville, we'd have them come up a day early, and then we'd have them over to the house for dinner, and the admiral would sit and talk to them that evening and find out kind of a debriefing before you leave Vietnam. What did you like? What did you didn't like? What were the lessons learned? What should I be doing? How could we get the hell out of here earlier? The Vietnamese is bad, as everybody says. The conversation would just kind of wander to whatever.
From what you and the Admiral saw and heard, and in terms of these lessons learned, was there sort of a dissemination of that? In other words, the Admiral said, these men here have discovered that this works or doesn't work, and so we can actually turn this into policy and we can transmit this to the rest of them.
Well, yes, there were some things. Many of the things that they said he couldn't. Mm-hmm. But he, as I said, I think his experience with these young people had a tremendous impact when he became CEO.
While he was there, this may be just an aside, but I would like to see if you have any memories of this specific incident. There was, an attempt to assassinate him.
Yeah, I was there that day.
Mm-hmm. What is your memory of that incident?
Well, we played volleyball every day. Just a way of exercising and getting rid of some of the energy that was built up. So on this particular day, the Admiral had gone out of town. I was not with him. I don't know, he was over at MACB or he had gone off someplace on a trip. I forget where it was, but I was at the compound. And all of a sudden I heard this explosion. And I ran outside, and there was a pretty big hole where the volleyball court was. Of course, we had a plan to protect the compound in the event we were ever attacked by the VC, similar to what the U.S. Embassy had been, so that the people that worked there, the U.S. Navy stewards, we had rifles, we had hand grenades, we had all kinds of things, and so we basically implemented this as best we could. Of course, there was nobody coming over the walls, and we never saw anybody. Mm-hmm. And it turned out somebody had come by on a motorcycle, and they had been watching our pattern of playing volleyball that day. We didn't play that day, but they had decided to throw this satchel over. And of course, they were after the Admiral.
How long after your arrival did this take place?
Well, it was quite a while.
So you can safely say then that this may be a response.
Oh, I think it was.
What you're doing here on these rivers is actually hurting the Viet Cong, and so they're going to...
No question, right. No question. He was targeted because he became, visible to the Viet Cong command structure, what he was doing. And they said, get rid of this guy,
So, maybe in an odd sort of sense, this could be almost flattering that they had marked him.
Oh, I don't think there's any question. I think it was, he had been targeted for assassination. was, I was up in my room when that explosion went off. Of course, it was front page in the Stars and Stripes, and it enhanced his reputation in country. Mm-hmm. You know, with Abrams and all the commanders. Here's a guy, because I remember Abrams telling him afterwards that he had to start having more bodyguards. See, when Abrams went around, there was Jeep in front of him and a Jeep behind him, and two machine guns mounted on each Jeep. He had four machine guns around him. Mm-hmm. Well, when we traveled, we had Marines in a Jeep behind us. And Abrams, I don't know what he ordered him, but he told him to, build up his protection when he traveled around town. So all of a sudden, we had Jeeps fore and aft.
Right. I guess the MACV compound was such that it was probably more secure from these opportunity attacks where somebody could just drive by him.
Oh, absolutely. See, we were right in the center of Saigon. We were in the home where General Westmoreland lived. That was the when Westmoreland was replaced, Abrams moved out to the MACV compound. But Westmoreland lived in his house, and it was right next to the Navy headquarters. But that's where Westmoreland had lived. And because of the threat, that's why Abrams moved into the compound. And so the house was vacant until someone got there. Because Veth was not living there, so he was living in the old Navy commander's headquarters. Home. So when Abrams left, that house set vacant. And then, when Westmoreland left, that house set vacant. And so in Zumwalt, the first couple of months we were in country, we lived in the place where Beth lived. And then Abrams told